Well, come, she drones. How may I direct your... She blinks suddenly at our images on the display, wipes sleep from her eyes, and loses all faculty of speech. I would like to speak with the Arch-Governor, I say. And may I say who is calling? It's the bloody damn Reaper of Mars, Severo barks. One moment, please. The copper's face is replaced by the pyramid of the society. Terribly predictable Vivaldi plays as we wait. Severo taps his fingers on his leg and murmurs his little tune under his breath. If your heart beats like a drum and your legs a little wet, it's because the reapers come to collect a little debt. Several minutes later, the jackal's pale face appears before us. He wears a jacket with a high white collar, and his hair is parted on the side. He does not leer at us. If anything, he looks amused as he continues to eat his breakfast. The Reaper and Ares, he says in a low drawl, mocking his own courtesy. He wipes his mouth on a napkin. You departed so quickly last time, I didn't have time to say farewell. I must say, you're looking positively radiant, Dara. Is Victor with you? Adrius, I say flatly, as you're no doubt aware, there has been an explosion at Sun Industries, and your silent partner, Quicksilver, has gone missing. I know it's a mess of jurisdiction, and the evidence won't be sorted for hours, maybe days. So I wanted to call and clarify the situation. We, the Sons of Ares, have kidnapped Quicksilver. He sets his spoon down to sip from his white coffee cup. I see. To what end? We will be holding him for ransom until you release all political prisoners illegally detained in your jails, and all low colors concentrated in internment camps. Additionally, you are to take responsibility for the murder of your father. Publicly. Is that all? The jackal asks, not displaying a flicker of emotion, though I know he's wondering how we discovered Quicksilver was his ally. You also have to personally kiss my pimply ass, Severo says. Lovely. The jackal looks off the screen to someone. My agents tell me a flight moratorium was instituted 10 minutes after the attack on Sun Industries, and the vessel which fled the scene disappeared into the hollows. Am I to assume, then, that you're still on Phobos? I pause as if caught off guard. If you do not comply, Quicksilver's life is forfeit. Lamentably, I do not negotiate with terrorists, especially ones who may be recording my conversation to broadcast it for political gain. The jackal sips his coffee again. I listened to your proposal. Now listen to mine. Run. Now. While you can. But know, wherever you go, wherever you hide, you cannot protect your friends. I'm going to kill them all, and put you back in the darkness with their severed heads for company. There is no way out, Darrow. This I promise you. He kills the signal. Think he'll send the Bone Riders before the Legions? Severo asks. Let's hope. Time to get moving. The Hollows is a city of cages, row upon row, column upon column of rusty metal homes linked together in the null gravity, as far as the eye can see, here in the heart of Phobos. Each cage a life in miniature. Clothing floats on hooks. Little portable thermal press grills sizzle with the foods of 100 different regions of Mars. Paper pictures cling to iron cage walls by bits of tape, showing distant lakes, mountains, and families gathered together. Everything here is dull and grey. The metal of the cages, the limp clothing. Even the tired and wasted faces of the oranges and reds were trapped here, thousands of kilometers from home. Sparks of color dance up from the datapads and holovisor that glow through the city, bits of dream scattered on twisted scrap metal. Men and women sit penitent over their little displays, watching their little programs, forgetting where they are in favor of where they'd wish to be. Many have taped paper or blankets over the sides of their walls to give them some semblance of privacy from their neighbors. But it's the scent and the sound you cannot escape. The throaty, unceasing rattle of cage doors slamming shut, locks clicking, men laughing and coughing, generators humming. Public holocans yapping and barking the dog language of distraction. All stirred and boiled together to make a thick soup of noise and shadowy light. Rollo once lived in negative south end of the city. Now it is deep syndicate territory. The Sons were chased out more than 2 months ago. I fly along the lines of plastic rope that weave through the cave canyons, passing dock workers and tower laborers who climb back to their little cage homes. They jerk their heads toward the throaty thrum of my new grav boots. It's an alien sound to them. One heard only over holovids or experimental virtual realities, low-world greens hawk for 50 credits a minute. Most will never have seen a peerless scarred in the flesh, much less one in full armor. I'm a terrifying spectacle. It was 7 hours ago that my lieutenants and I clustered together in the Sons of Ares ready room, and I told them, and Dancer back in Tinos, my plan. 6 hours since I heard of Kavix's escape from our detention cell. Someone let him out. 5 hours since Victra delivered Quicksilver and Mateo back to their tower, where Quicksilver has spent the remainder of the night activating his own cells and contacts in the Blue Hives, making preparation for this moment. 4 hours since Quicksilver joined his security teams with Sons of Ares and gave them access to his armories and his weapons depots. And we received word that 2 Augustus destroyers were inbound from the orbital docks. 3 hours since Ragnar and Rollo took 1,000 Sons of Ares to the garbage hangars on level 43C to prepare their skiffs. 2 hours since one of Quicksilver's private yachts was prepped for launch. 1 hour since the Society destroyers deployed 4 troop transports to dock at the Skyresh Interplanetary Spaceport, and the new coat of blood-red paint on my armor dried, and I donned it to march to war. All is ready. Now I carve a wake of silence into the heart of the hollows. My bone-white razor is on my arm. At my side flies Severo, wearing the huge spiked helmet of Ares with pride. He brought it along, but the rest of his armor is borrowed from Quicksilver. It's cutting-edge tech, better even than the suits we wore for Augustus. Holiday follows behind, along with 100 Sons of Ares. The Sons are awkward on their grav boots. Some carry razors, others pulse fists, but, per my orders, not one wears a helmet as we fly. I wanted these low colors of the stacks witnessing our treason, so that they feel emboldened by reds and oranges and obsidians wearing the armor of their masters. The faces are a blur. 100,000 peering from the homes in every direction. Pale and confused, most under the age of 40. Reds and oranges brought here with false promises, just like Rollo, with families down on Mars, just like Rollo. Neighbors point in my direction. I see my name on their lips. Somewhere, the Syndicate watchmen will be dialing their superiors, relaying the news to the police or the Securitas anti-terrorism apparatus that the Reaper lives, and he is on Phobos. I bait the beasts. As I coast into the central hub of the city, I say a silent prayer, willing Io to give me strength. There, like some pulsing electronic idol, fenced in by metal bramble, A holographic display casts society comedy programming, 100 meters long, 50 meters broad. It bathes the circle of cages around it in sickly neon light. Speakers laugh on cue. Blue light plays over my armor. Locks jingle as they're undone, and cages are pushed open so their inhabitants can sit on the edge and dangle their legs off to watch me without looking through the cage bars. Quicksilver's greens focus their helmet cameras on me. The suns array around, eyes smoldering out of the low colors. My honor guard, their red hair floating like 100 angry torch flames. Holiday and Ares flank me to either side, floating 200 meters in the air, surrounded by cages. Silence gripping the city, except the laugh track of the comedy. It's sick and weird as it cackles out of the speakers. I nod to Quicksilver's greens, and they cut the noise, and somewhere in his tower, the hacker teams he's assembled hijack every broadcast on the moon and issue commands to secondary data hubs on Earth, Luna, the asteroid belt, Mercury, the moons of Jupiter, so my message will burn across the blackness of space, taking over the data web that links mankind. Quicksilver is proving his allegiance with this broadcast, using the network he helped the Jackal build. This is not like Io's death. A viral video you have to dig for in the dark spaces of the Holonet. This is a grand roar across the society, broadcasting on 10 billion hollows to 18 billion people. They gave these screens to us as chains. Today, we make them hammers. Carnos Aubalona had his faults. But he was right when he said that all we have in this life is our shout into the wind. He shouted his own name, and I learned the folly in that. But before I begin the war that will claim me, one way or another, I will make my shout. And it will be something far greater than my own name, far greater than a roar of family pride. It is the dream I've carried and shepherded since I was 16. Io appears beneath me on the hologram, replacing the comedy. A ghostly giant of the girl I knew. Her face is quiet and pale and angrier than in my dreams. Hair dull and stringy. Clothing drab and ragged. But her eyes burn out from her gray surroundings, bright as the blood on her mangled back as she looks up from the metal whipping box. Her mouth barely seems to open. Just a sliver of space between her lips. But her song bleeds from her, voice thin and fragile as a spring dream. My son, remember the chains when gold ruled with iron reins. We roared and roared and twisted and screamed. For ours a veil of better dreams. She echoes across the metal city, louder than she echoed in that far-off lost city of stone. Her light flickering across the pale faces watching from their cages. These oranges and reds who never knew her in life, but hear her in death. They're silent and sad as she has walked to the gallows. I hear my vain cries, see myself sagging against gray hands, feel I'm there again, the hard-packed dirt on my knees as the world falls out from under me. Augustus speaks with Pliny and Leto as frayed hemp loops around Io's neck. Hatred radiates from the faces in the stacks. I could no more stop Io's death then than I can stop it now. It's as if it always has been. My wife falls. I flinch, hearing the rustling of her clothing, the creaking of the rope. And I look down at the hologram, forcing myself to watch as the boy I was stumbles forward to wrap his hands with their red sigils around her kicking legs. I watch him kiss her ankle and pull her feet with all his feeble strength. Her Hymenthus falls, and I speak. I would have lived in peace, but my enemies brought me war. My name is Daro of Lycos. You know my story. It is but an echo of your own. They came to my home and killed my wife, not for singing a song, but for daring to question their reign, for daring to have a voice. For centuries, millions beneath the soil of Mars have been fed lies from cradle to grave. That lie has been revealed to them. Now they've entered the world you know, and they suffer as you do. Man was born free, but from the ocean shores to the crater cities of Mercury, to the ice waste of Pluto, down to the mines of Mars, he is in chains. Chains made of duty, hunger, fear. Chains hammered to our necks by a race that we lifted up. A race that we empowered. Not to rule, not to reign, but to lead us from a world torn by war and greed. Instead, they have led us into darkness. They have used the systems of order and prosperity for their own gain. They expect your obedience, ignore your sacrifice, and hoard the prosperity that your hands create. To hold tight to their reign, they forbid our dreams, saying a person is only as good as the color of their eyes, of their sigils. I remove my gloves and clench my right fist in the air as Io did before she died, but unlike Io, my hands bear no sigils. Removed by Mickey when I was carved in Tinos, I am the first soul in hundreds of years to walk without them. The silence in the hollows gives way to sounds of shock, fear. But now, I stand before you, a man unbound. I stand before you, my brothers and sisters, to ask you to join me, to throw yourselves on the machines of industry, to unite behind the sons of Ares. Take back your cities, your prosperity. Dare to dream of better worlds than these. Slavery is not peace. Freedom is peace. And until we have that, it is our duty to make war. This is no license for savagery or genocide. If a man rapes, you kill him on the spot. If a man murders civilians, high or low, you kill him on the spot. This is war. But you are on the side of good. And that carries a heavy burden. We rise not for hate, not for vengeance, but for justice. For your children. For their future. I speak now to gold, to the Oriat who rule. I have walked your halls, broken your schools, eaten at your tables, and suffered your gallows. You tried to kill me. You could not. I know your power. I know your pride. And I have seen how you will fall. For 700 years you have ruled over the dominion of man, and this is all you have given us. It is not enough. Today, I declare your rule to be at its end. Your cities are not your cities. Your vessels are not your vessels. Your planets are not your planets. They were built by us. And they belong to us, the common trust of man. Now, we take them back. Never mind the darkness you spread. Never mind the night you summon. We will rage against it. We will howl and fight till our last breath, not just in the mines of Mars, but on the shores of Venus, on the dunes of Io's sulfur seas, on the glacial valleys of Pluto. We will fight in the towers of Ganymede and the ghettos of Luna and the storm-stricken oceans of Europa. And if we fall, others will take our place, because we are the tide. And we are rising. Then Severo slams his fist against his chest. Once, twice, thumping it rhythmically. It is echoed by the 200 sons of Ares, their fists pounding their chests. By the howlers. In the steel mesh of the cages, men and women thump their fists into the walls till it sounds like the heartbeat rising through the bowels of this vampire moon, up through the hives of blues, where they sit drinking coffee and studying gravitational mathematics under the warm lights of their intellectual communes, through the grey barracks in each precinct, among the silvers at their trading desks, the golds in their mansions and yachts. Out through the black ink that separates our little bubbles of life, before careening down into the halls of the jackal's lonely hold on Attica, where he sits in his winter throne, surrounded by a sea of bent necks. There our sound rattles in his ears. There he hears my wife's heart beat on. And he cannot stop it, as it goes down and down into the mines of Mars, playing on the screens as reds beat on their tables, and the copper magistrates watch in swelling fear as the miners look hatefully up through the duroglass that keeps them imprisoned. Her heart beats mutinously through the bustling oceanside promenades of the archipelagos of Venus, as sailboats float proudly in the harbor, and shopping bags hang in frightened hands, and golds look to their drivers, their gardeners, the men who power their cities. It beats through the tin-roofed mess halls of the wheat and soybean latifundia that cover the great plains of Earth, where reds use machines to toil under the huge sun to feed mouths of people they will never meet, in places they will never be. It beats even along the spine of the Empire, raging through the spiked city moon of Luna, passing by the Sovereign in her glass-high refuge, to thunder on down, snaking electrical wires and drying clothing lines, to the lost city, where a pink girl makes breakfast after a long night of thankless work, where a brown cook leans away from his stove to hear, as grease spatters his apron, and a grey watches from the window of his patrol skiff, as a violet girl smashes the front door of a post office and his datapad summons him back to the station for emergency riot protocols. And it beats inside me, this terrible hope, as I know that the end has begun, and I am finally awake. "Break the chains!" I roar, and my people roar back. "Ragnar," I say into my comm, "bring it down." The greens cut to a different feed as the fists thump and the cages rattle, and we see a distant shot of the Society's military spire on Phobos, a Goliath of a building with docks and vestibules for weapons, efficient and ugly as a crab. From it, the jackal maintains his grip on the moon. There, the greys and obsidians will be donning armor under pale lights, rushing through metal halls in tight lines, stocking ammunition belts, and kissing pictures of their loved ones so they can come down to the hollows and make this heart stop beating. But they will never make it here, because as fists pound even harder into cages, the lights of that military spire go black. all her power turned off by Rolo and his men with the access cards provided by Quicksilver. We could have bombed the building, but I wanted a triumph of daring, of achievement, not destruction. We need heroes, not another Ash City. And so, a small squadron of a dozen maintenance skiffs coasts into view. Flat, ugly flyers designed to port reds and oranges like Rolo to their construction work on towers. Craggy stingrays covered with barnacles. But it isn't barnacles that cling to them now. Another camera takes a closer angle, and we can see each skiff is covered with hundreds of men. Reds and oranges in their clunky EVA suits. Almost half the Sons of Ares on Phobos. Boots against the deck. Harnesses latched into exterior buckles of the ship. They carry their welding gear, and have Quicksilver's weapons patched onto their legs with magnetic tape. Among them, 2 feet taller than the others, is their general, Ragnar Volarus, in armor freshly painted bone white, a red sling blade painted on the chest and back. As the skiffs near the Society military spire, they divide down the length of the building. Sons fire magnetic harpoons to tether the skiffs to the steel, and then they go with practiced ease along the lines, flying at implausible speeds, as the little motors on their buckles pull them, one by one, along toward the building. It's like watching reds in the mines. The grace and nimbleness, even in the clunky suits, dazzles. More than 1,000 welders pour onto the vast building like we did Quicksilver's spire, but they're not playing for stealth, and they're better in null gravity than we were. Magnetic boots, clutching metal girders, they skitter across the building, melting through the viewports and entering with extreme prejudice. Dozens are ripped to shreds as greys inside fire railguns out the glass, but they fire back and pour inward. A rip-wing patrol banks in along the outside of the building and rakes 2 of the skiffs with chain guns. Men turn to mist. A son fires a rocket at the rip-wing. Fire blooms and vanishes, and the ship cracks in half in a gout of purple flame. The camera follows Ragnar as he breaches a window, enters a hall, and runs full tilt into a trio of gold knights, one who I recognize as the cousin of Priam, the man Severo killed in the passage, and whose mother owns the deed to Phobos. Ragnar flows through the young knight without stopping, swinging both razors like scissors and undulating the war cry of his people, followed by a pack of heavily armed welders and laborers. I told him I wanted the spire. I didn't tell him how to take it. He walked off with Rolo, putting an arm around the man. Now the world's watcher's slave become a hero. "This moon belongs to you," Severo says, roaring to the roiling cage city. "Rise and take it! Rise, men of Mars! Women of Mars, rise! You bloody damn bastards, rise!" Men and women are pulling themselves from their homes, donning their boots and jackets, pushing themselves toward us so that thousands clog the air avenues, crawling over the outside of the cages. The tide has risen, and I feel a deep terror in wondering exactly what will wash away. "Rape and murder of innocents is punishable by death. This is war, but you are on the side of good. Remember that, you little shitheads. Protect your brothers. Protect your sisters. All residents of Section 1A to 4C, you're to take the armory in Level 14. Residents of Section 5C to 3F are to take the water purification center on..." Severo seizes control of the battle, and the howlers and sons disperse to organize the mob. It isn't an army, but a battering ram. Many will die. And when they die, more will rise in their place. This is just one of the stack cities of Phobos. The sons will supply them with weapons, but there won't be nearly enough to go around. Their sword is the press of flesh. Severo will lead them, spend them. Victra in Quicksilver spires will guide them, and the moon will fall to the rebellion. But I will not be here to see it. Chapter 24. Hic sunt leones. Phobos is in uproar. Detonations shake the moon as Holliday and I run through the halls. Golds and silvers evacuate the needles in their flashing luxury yachts, as kilometers beneath, the hollows swarm with packs of low-color mobs, armed with welding torches, fusion cutters, pipes, black-market scorchers, and old-fashioned slug throwers. The mobs are overwhelming the tram systems and passages to gain access to the mid-sector and needles, while the Society military garrison, caught reeling from the attack on their headquarters, rushes to stop the upward migration. The legions have training and organization on their side. We have numbers and surprise. Not to mention fury. No matter how many checkpoints the Greys blockade, how many trams the Greys destroy, the low-colors will seep through the cracks because they made this place, because they have allies among the mid-colors, thanks to Quicksilver. They open derelict transportation tunnels, hijack cargo ships in the industrial sector, pack them full of men and women, and steer them for the luxury hangars and the needles, or even towards the public Skyresh interplanetary spaceport, where cruise liners and passenger ships are being loaded with evacuees. I'm remotely jacked into Quicksilver security grid, watching high colors stampede over one another, carrying luggage and valuables and children. Martian Navy ripwings and fast-moving fighters dart through the towers, shooting down the rebel ships rising from the hollows toward the needles. The debris from a destroyed low-color skiff crashes through the vaulted glass and steel ceiling of a Skyresh terminal, killing civilians and shattering any illusion I might have had that this war would be sanitary. Ducking away from a mob of low-colors, Holliday and I arrive outside a derelict hangar in the old freight garages, which haven't been used since before the time of Augustus. It's quiet here. Abandoned. The old pedestrian entrance is welded shut. Radiation signs warn potential scavengers away, but the doors open for us with a deep groan when a modern retinal scanner built into the metal registers my irises, as Quicksilver said it would. The hangar is a vast rectangle skinned with dust and cobwebs. In the center of the hangar's deck sits a silver 70-meter-long luxury yacht, shaped like a sparrow in flight. It's a custom-built model out of the Venusian shipyards, ostentatious, fast, and perfect for an obscenely wealthy war refugee. Quicksilver plucked it from his fleet to help us blend in with the migrating upper class. Its rear cargo plank is down, and inside the bird is filled to capacity with black crates stamped with the Sun Industries' winged heel, inside of which are several billion credits worth of high-tech weapons and equipment. Holliday whistles. Gotta love deep pockets. The fuel would cost my annual wages twice over. We cross the hangar to meet Quicksilver's pilot. The trim young blue waits at the bottom of the ramp. She has no eyebrows and her head is bald. Winding blue lines pulse beneath the skin, where subdermal synaptic links connect her remotely to the ship. She snaps to attention, eyes wide. Clearly, she had no idea who she was transporting until now. "Sir, I am Lieutenant Vesta. I'll be your pilot today. And I must say, it's an honor to have you on board." There's three levels to the yacht. The upper and bottom for gold use, the middle for cooks, servants, and crew. There's four staterooms, a sauna, and creme leather seats with dainty little chocolates and napkins sitting primly on armrests in the passenger cabin to the far back of the cockpit. I pocket one, and then a couple more. As Holliday and Vesta prep the ship, I strip off my pulse armor in the passenger cabin and unpack winter gear from one of the boxes. I dress in skin-tight nanofiber weave that's much like scarab skin, but instead of black, it's mottled white and looks oily except for textured grips on the elbows, gloves, buttocks and knees. It's crafted for polar temperatures and water immersion. It's also 100 pounds lighter than our pulse armor, is immune to digital component failures, and has the added benefit of not needing batteries. Much as I enjoy using 400 million credits worth of technology to make me a flying human tank, sometimes warm pants are more valuable. And we'll always have the pulse armor if we need it in a pinch. I'm struck by the silence in the cargo bay and the hangar as I finish lacing my boots. There's still 15 minutes left on my datapad's timer, so I sit on the edge of the ramp, legs dangling off, to wait for Ragnar. I pull the chocolates from my pocket and slowly peel the foil off. Taking half a bite, I let the chocolate sit on my tongue, waiting for it to melt, as I always do. And as always, I lose patience and chew it before the bottom half has melted through. Ea would make candy last for days, when we were lucky enough to have it. I set my datapad on the ground and watch the helmet cameras of my friends as they wage my war for Phobos. Their chatter trembles out of the datapad speakers, echoing in the vast metal chamber. Severo's in his element, rushing through the central ventilation unit with hundreds of suns loading themselves into the air ducts. I feel guilty for sitting here watching them, but we each have our parts to play. The door we entered through opens with a groan, and Ragnar and two of the obsidian howlers enter the room. Fresh from the battlefield, Ragnar's white armor is dented and stained. "Did you play gently with the fools, my goodman?" I call down from the ramp in my thickest high lingo. In reply, he tosses up to me a curul, a twisted gold scepter of power given to high-ranking military officers. This one is tipped with a screaming banshee and a splash of crimson.
"The tower has fallen," Ragnar says. "Rollo and the sons finish my work. These are the stains of Sub-Governor Priscilla Aucan."
"Well done, my friend," I say, taking the scepter in my hands. On it is carved the deeds of the Khan family, which owned the two moons of Mars and once followed Bellona to war. Among great warriors and statesmen, there's a young man I recognize standing by a horse.
"What is wrong?" Ragnar asks.
"Nothing," I say. "I knew her son is all. Priam. He seemed decent enough."
"Decent is not enough," Ragnar says forlornly. "Not for their world."
With a grunt, I bend the curul against my knee and toss it back to him to show my agreement. "Give it to your sister. Time to go." Glancing back at the hangar with a frown, he checks his datapad and files past me into the cargo hold. I try to wipe the blood from the curul off my white suit's leg. It just smears over the oily fabric, giving me a red stripe on my thigh. I close the ramp behind me. Inside, I help Ragnar out of his pulse armor and let him slip into the winter gear as I join Holiday and Vesta as they initiate pre-flight launch. "Remember, we're refugees. Aim for the largest convoy heading out of here and stick to them." Vesta nods. It's an old hangar, so it has no pulse field. All that separates us from space are 5-story-tall steel doors. They rumble as the motors begin to retract them into the ceiling and floor.
"Stop!"
I say. Vesta sees what caught my attention a second after I do, and her hand flashes to the controls, stopping the doors before they part and open the hangar to vacuum.
"I'll be damned," Holiday says, peering out the cockpit to a small figure blocking our ship's path to space. "It's the Lion."
Mustang stands in front of the ship, illuminated by our headlights, her hair washed white by the blinding light. She blinks as Holiday cuts the headlights from the cockpit, and I make my way to her through the dim hangar. Her dancing eyes dissect me as I come.
They dart from my sigil-barren hands to the scar I've kept on my face. What does she see? Does she see my resolve? My fear? In her I see so much. The girl I fell in love with in the snow is gone. Replaced in the last 15 months by a woman. A thin, intense leader of vast and enduring strength and alarming intellect. Eyes kinetic, binged by circles of exhaustion, and trapped in a face made pale from long days in sunless lands and metal halls. Everything she is dwells behind her eyes. She has her father's mind, her mother's face, and a distant, foreboding sort of intelligence that can give you wings or crush you to the earth. And just at her hip sits a ghost cloak with a cooling unit. She has watched us since we arrived. How did she get inside the hangar? "Lo, Reaper," she says playfully as I come to a halt. "Lo, Mustang." I searched the rest of the hangar. "How did you find me?" She frowns in confusion. "I thought you wanted me to come. Ragnar told Kavax where I could find you." She trails off. "Oh, you didn't know." "No." I look back up at the ship's mirror cockpit windows, where Ragnar must be watching me. The man's overstepped his bounds. Even as I arranged a war, he went behind my back and endangered my mission. Now I know exactly how Severo felt. "Where have you been?" she asks me. "With your brother." "Then the execution was a ruse, meant to make us stop looking." There's so much more to say. So many questions and accusations that could fly between us. But I didn't want to see her because I don't know where to begin. What to say, what to ask for. "I don't have time for small talk, Mustang. I know you came to Phobos to surrender to the Sovereign. Now why are you here talking to me?"
"Don't talk down to me," she says sharply. "I wasn't surrendering. I was making peace."
"You're not the only one with people to protect. My father ruled Mars for decades. Its people are as much a part of me as they are a part of you."
"You left Mars at the mercy of your brother," I say.
"I left Mars to save it," she corrects. "You know everything is a compromise. And you know it's not Mars you're angry at me for leaving."
"I need you to stand aside, Mustang. This is not about us, and I don't have time to bicker. I'm leaving, so either you move, or we open the door and fly through you."
"Fly through me?" she laughs. "You know, I didn't have to come alone. I could have come with my bodyguards. I could have lay in wait to ambush you, or reported you to the Sovereign to salvage the peace you ruined. But I didn't. Can you stop for a single moment to think why?"
She takes a step forward.
"You said to me in that tunnel that you want a better world. Can't you see that I listened? That I joined the Moon Lords because I believe in something better?"
"Yet you surrendered."
"Because I could not watch my brother's reign of terror continue. I want peace."
"This is not the time for peace," I say.
"Gory hell, you're thick. I know that. Why do you think I'm here? Why do you think I've worked with Orion and kept your soldiers at their stations?"
I examine her. "I honestly don't know."
"I'm here because I want to believe in you, Darrow. I want to believe in what you said in that tunnel. I ran from you because I didn't want to accept that the only answer was the sword. But the world we live in has conspired to take everything I love away. My mother, my father, my brothers. I will not let it take the friends I have left. I will not let it take you."
"What are you saying?" I ask. I'm saying that I'm not letting you out of my sight. I'm coming with you.
It's my turn to laugh. You don't even know where I'm going. You're wearing sealskin. Ragnar's on board. You've declared open rebellion. Now you're leaving in the middle of the largest battle the Rising has ever seen. Really, Dara, it doesn't take a genius to deduce that now you're using this ship to pretend to be a gold refugee to escape and go to the Valkyrie Spires to beseech Ragnar's mother to provide an army.
Damn. I try not to let my surprise show. This is why I did not want to involve Mustang. Inviting her into the game is adding another dimension I can't control. She could destroy my gambit with a single call to her brother, to the Sovereign, telling them where I am going. Everything relies on misdirection, on my enemies thinking I am on Phobos. She knows what I'm thinking. I can't let her leave this hangar.
The Telemannuses know as well, she says, knowing my mind. But I'm tired of having insurance plans against you. Tired of playing games. You and I have pushed each other away because of broken trust. Aren't you tired of that? Of the secrets between us? Of the guilt?
You know I am. I laid my secrets bare in the tunnels of Lycos.
Then let this be our second chance. For you, for me, for both our people. I want what you want. And when you and I are aligned, when have we ever lost? Together we can build something, Darrow.
You're suggesting an alliance,
I say quietly. Yes. Her eyes are afire. The might of House Augustus and Telemannus and Arcos, united with the Rising. With the Reaper, with Orion and all her ships, the society would tremble.
Millions will die in that war, I say. You know that. The Peerless Scarred will fight to the last gold. Can you stomach that? Can you watch that happen?
To build, we must break, she says.
I was listening. Still, I shake my head. There's too much to overcome between us, between our people. It would be a qualified victory on her terms.
How could I ask my men to trust a gold army? How could I trust you? You can't. That is why I'm coming with you. To prove I believe in your wife's dream.
But you have to prove something to me. That you are worthy of my trust in turn.
I know you can break. I need to see that you can build.
I need to see what you will build.
If the blood we will shed is for something.
Prove that, and you have my sword.
Fail, and you and I will go our separate ways.
She cocks her head at me.
So what say you, Helldiver?
Do you want to give it one more go?
Chapter 25 Exodus. I help unbuckle Mustang's pulse armor in the cargo hold.
Cold gear is in here. I gesture to a large plastic box. Boots in there.
Quicksilver gave you the keys to his armory?
She asks, eyeing the winged heel on the boxes.
How many fingers did it cost him?
None, I say. He's a son of Ares.
What, now?
I grin. Comforting knowing the world isn't an open book for her. The engines rumble, and the ship rises underneath us.
Get dressed and join us in the cabin.
I leave her behind to change in private. I was more gruff than I intended, but it felt strange smiling in her presence.
I find Ragnar leaning back in his chair in the passenger cabin, eating chocolates, white boots up on the adjacent armrest. No offense, but what the hell are you doing?
Holliday asks me. She stands, arms crossed, between the cockpit and the passenger cabin.
sir.
Taking a risk, I say. I know it might seem strange to you, Holiday, but I go back with her.
She's the definition of the elite. Worse than Victra. Her father
killed my wife, I say. So if I can stomach it, so can you. Holiday makes a whistling sound and heads back to the cabin, unhappy with our new ally.
So, the Mustang joined our quest,
Ragnar says. She's getting dressed, I reply. You had no right to let Kavax go, much less tell him where we would be. What if they gave us up, Ragnar? What if they ambushed us? You would never have seen your home. If they find out we're there, they'll never let your people off the surface. They'll kill them all. Did you think of that?
He eats another chocolate.
A man thinks he can fly, but he is afraid to jump. A poor friend pushes him from behind.
He looks up at me.
A good friend jumps with.
You've been reading Stoneside, haven't you? Ragnar nods.
Theodora gave it to me. Lorne Au Arcos was a great man.
He'd be glad you think so, but take everything with a grain of salt. The biographer took some liberties, especially in his early life.
Lorne would have told you that we need her, now in war, and after in peace. If we do not bring her to our cause, then we will not win until every gold is dead. That is not why I fight.
Ragnar rises to greet Mustang as she joins us. The last time they stood eye to eye, she had a gun pointed at his head. Ragnar, you've been busy since I last saw you. Not a gold alive doesn't know and fear your name. Thank you for releasing Kavax.
Family is dear, Ragnar says, but I warn you. We go to my lands. You are under my protection. If you play your tricks, if you play your games, that protection is forfeit. And even you will not survive long on the ice without me, daughter of the lion. Do you understand?
Mustang bows her head respectfully. I do. And I will repay your faith in me, Ragnar. I promise you that.
Enough chatter. Time to buckle up.
Holiday snaps from the cabin. Vesta's synced with the ship and pushing out of the hangar. We find our seats. There's 20 to choose from, but Mustang takes the one next to me in the left aisle. Her hand grazes my hip accidentally as she reaches for her seat harness. Our ship departs the hangar, silently floating forward into the vacuum of the dim, subcutaneous industrial world of Phobos. Pipes and loading docks and garbage bays as far as we can see. Closed off to the stars and the light of the sun. Few ships as lovely as ours have ever flown so far beneath the surface of Phobos. The word low sector is rendered in white paint over an industrial transport hub where men pour into ships, and the ships trundle up out of this dim world toward the sector gates that the suns have breached. Our sleek yacht passes a motley fleet of slow-moving garbage haulers and freighters. Inside, men and women huddle quietly together in windowless, dirty steel cubes. Sweat drenches their backs, their hands shake, holding unfamiliar instruments. Weapons. They pray they can be as brave as they've always imagined themselves to be. Then they land in some gold hangar. The sons will shout orders, the doors will open, and they will meet war. I silently pray for them, clenching my hands as I stare out the window. I feel Mustang watching me, measuring the tides deep within. Soon we leave the industrial stacks behind, trading the dim recesses for the neon advertisements that bathe the space boulevards of the mid-sector. Man-made canyons of steel to either side. Trams, elevators, apartments. Every screen connected to the web has been slaved by Quicksilver's hackers, showing images of Severo and the Sons, overrunning security gates and checkpoints, painting scythes on walls. And around us, the city of 30 million churns. Deep space commercial transports racing past little civilian taxis and skippers meant to go between the buildings here. Freighters soar from the hollows, up through the mid-sector toward the needles. A flight of ripwings hunts through the streets above us. I hold my breath. With a flip of a trigger, they could shred us. But they don't. They register our high-color ID and hail us over the comms and offer an escort out of the war zone toward a current of yachts and skiffs that blaze quietly away from the moon.
Stirring speech.
Victra purrs over the ship's comm as I answer the call from Quicksilver's tower, her bored voice at odds with the warring world around us.
Clown and Screwface just took Skyresh's main terminals. Rolo's men have seized the water systems for the mid-sector. Quicksilver's networks are broadcasting it all the way to Luna. Scythes popping up everywhere. There's riots in Aegea, Corinth, everywhere on Mars. And we're hearing the same from Earth and Luna. Municipal buildings are falling. Police stations burning. You've woken the rabble.
They'll hit back soon.
As you said, darling. We massacred the first responders the Jackal sent. Got a few bone riders, just as we wanted. No Lilith or Thistle, though.
Damn. Worth a shot.
Martian Navy is on its way from Deimos. The Legions are coming, and we're making our final preparations.
Good. Good.
Victra, I need you to let Severo know that we've added a member to our expedition.
Mustang's joined us. Silence from her.
Am I on a private line?
Holiday tosses me a headset from the cockpit. I wrestle the headset on. You are now. You don't agree. The bitterness in her tone is acute.
Here are my thoughts. You can't trust her. Look at her brother. Her father. Greed is in her blood. Of course she would ally with us. It fits her aims.
I watch Mustang as Victra speaks.
She needs us because she's losing her war. But what happens when we give her what she needs? What happens when we're in her way? Will you be able to put her down? Will you be able to pull the trigger?
Yes. Victra's words linger as we pass Phobos's giant glass spires. Cockpit skimming a dozen meters above the panes of the building. Inside royal little worlds of madness. The rising has reached the needles in this district of the city. Low colors push inexorably through the halls, grays and silvers barricading doors, pinks standing in a bedroom over a bleeding old Gold and his wife, knives in hand. Three silver children watching Ares on a wall-sized hollow as their parents speak in the library. And at last, a Gold woman in a sky-blue cocktail dress, pearls about her neck, gold hair unbound to her waist. She stands near a window, as Sons of Ares spread through the building, levels beneath her penthouse. Engulfed in her own drama, she raises a scorcher to her golden head, body stiff in imagined majesty. Her finger tightens around the trigger. And we're past, leaving her life and the chaos behind to join with the flow of yachts and pleasure craft that flee the battle for the safety of the planet. Most of the refugees call Mars home. Their ships, unlike ours, are not equipped for deep space. Now they scatter over the planet's atmosphere like burning seeds, most plunging straight for the spaceport of Corinth beneath us in the middle of the thermic sea. Others skimming over the atmosphere, disregarding designated transit lanes. Racing past the Jackal's hastily erected blockade and the satellite level, toward their homes in the opposite hemisphere. Ripwings and wasps from the military frigates flash after them, trying to herd them back to the designated avenues.
But entitlement and chaos are a poor mix. Mania grips these fleeing golds.
The Dido,
Mustang says quietly to herself, eyeing a glass ship the shape of a sailboat to our starboard.
Drusilla Auran's vessel. She taught me how to paint watercolors when I was little.
But my attention is farther out, where ugly, dark vessels without the flashing hulls or fanciful lines of the pleasure craft race toward Phobos.
It's more than half the Martian defense fleet.
Frigates, torch ships, destroyers. Even two dreadnoughts. I wonder if the Jackal is on one of those bridges.
Likely not.
It's probably Lilith who leads the detachment, or some other praetor newly appointed in his regime. Antonia has been dispatched to aid Roke on the rim. Their ships will be packed with lifelong soldiers, men and women as hard as we are. Many who fell in my iron reign. And they will cut through the mob I've summoned inside Phobos like paper. They'll be furious and confident.
The more the better.
It's a trap, isn't it?
Mustang asks quietly.
You never meant to hold Phobos.
Do you know how the Inuit tribes of Earth killed wolves? I ask. She doesn't. Slower and weaker than the wolves, they chiseled knives till they were razor sharp, coated them in blood, and stuck them upright in the ice. Then the wolves would come and lick the blood. And as the wolf licks faster and faster, he's so ravenous he doesn't realize until it's too late that the blood he's drinking is his own.
I nod to the passing military vessels.
They hate that I was one of them. How many prime soldiers do you think those ships will launch at Phobos to take me? The great abomination for their own glory. Pride will again be the downfall of your color.
You're trying to get them on the station,
she says, understanding.
Because you don't need Phobos.
Like you said, I'm going to the Valkyrie Spires for an army. Orion and you might still have the remnants of my fleet, but we will need more ships than that. Severo is waiting in the ventilation system of the hangars. When the assault forces land to take back the military spire and the needles, they'll leave their shuttles behind in those hangars. Severo will descend from his hiding place, hijack the shuttles, and return them home to their ships, packed with all the suns we have left.
And you honestly believe you can control the obsidian? She asks.
Not me. Him. I nod to Ragnar. They live in fear of their gods in the Board of Quality Control's Asgard station. Golds in suits of armor playing at Odin and Freya. Same way that I lived in fear of the Greys in the pot. As we were cowed by the Proctors. Ragnar's going to show them just how mortal their gods really are.
How?
We will kill them, Ragnar says. I have sent friends ahead months ago to spread the truth. We will return to my mother and my sister as heroes, and I will tell them their gods are false with my own tongue. I will show them how to fly. I will give them weapons, and this ship will carry them to Asgard, and we will conquer it as Darrow conquered Olympus. Then we will free the other tribes, and carry them away from this land on Quicksilver's ships.
That's why you have a gory damn armory back there,
Mustang says.
What do you think?
I ask her.
Possible.
Insane, she says, awed by the audacity of it. Might be possible, though.
Only if Ragnar can actually control them.
I will not control. I will lead.
He says it with quiet certainty.
Mustang admires the man for a moment.
I believe you will.
I watch Ragnar as he looks back out the window.
What passes behind those dark eyes?
This is the first time I felt like he's not telling me something. He already deceived me by releasing Kavax. What else does he plan?
We listen in tense silence to the radio waves crackle with yacht captains requesting docking clearance on the military frigates instead of continuing down to the planet. Connections are used, bribes offered, strings pulled, men weep and egg. These civilians are discovering that their place in the world is smaller than they imagined. They do not matter. In war, men lose what makes them great. Their creativity, their wisdom, their joy. All that's left is their utility. War is not monstrous for making corpses of men so much as it is for making machines of them. And woe to those who have no use in war except to feed the machines. The peerless guard know this cold truth, and they have trained for centuries for this new age of war. Killing in the passage. Struggling through the deprivation of the Institute so that they might have worth when war comes. Time for pixies with deep pockets and expensive tastes to appreciate the realities of life. You do not matter unless you can kill. The bill, as Lorne often said, comes at the end. Now the pixies pay. A Gold Peter's voice cuts through the speakers of our ship, ordering the refugee ships to redirect toward authorized transit lanes and steer clear of Navy warships or they will be fired upon. The Praetor cannot afford unauthorized vessels within 100 kilometers of her ship. They could carry bombs, could carry Sons of Ares. Two yachts ignore the warnings and are ripped apart as one of the cruisers fires railguns into their hulls. The Praetor repeats her order. This time it is obeyed. I look over at Mustang and wonder what she thinks of this. Of me. Wishing she could be somewhere quiet, where 1,000 things didn't pull at us. Where I ask about her instead of the war.
Feels like the end of the world, she says.
No. I shake my head. It is the beginning of a new one. I have to believe that. The planetscape below is blue and speckled white as we pretend to follow the designated coordinates along the western hemisphere at the equator. Tiny green islands ringed with tan beaches wink up at us from the indigo waters of the thermic sea. Beneath, ships jerk and burn as they hit atmosphere before us, like phosphorus firecrackers Eo and I played with as children, kicking spasmodically and glowing orange, then blue, as heat friction builds along their shields. Our blue veers us away, following a series of other ships who depart the general flow of traffic for their own homes. Soon, Phobos is half a planet away. The continents pass beneath. One by one, the other ships descend and we're left alone on our journey to the uncivilized pole, flying past several dozen society satellites that monitor the southernmost continent. They, too, have been hacked into recycling information pulled from 3 years ago. We're invisible, for now. Not just to our enemies, but to our friends. Mustang leans from her chair, peering up into the cockpit. What is that? She gestures to the sensor display. A single dot follows behind us. Another refugee ship from Phobos. The pilot answers. Civilian vessel, no weapons. But it's closing fast, trailing behind us by 200 kilometers. If it's a civilian vessel, why did it just appear on our sensors? Mustang asks. It could have sensor shielding. Dampeners, Holiday says warily. The ship closes to 40 kilometers. Something is wrong here. Civilian vessels don't have that sort of acceleration, Mustang says. Dive, I say. Get us through the atmosphere now. Holiday, on the gun. The blue slips into defense protocols, increasing our speed, strengthening our rear shields. We hit atmosphere,
My teeth rattle together. The ship's electronic voice suggests passengers find their seats. Holliday stumbles up, rushing past us to the tail gun. Then a warning siren trills as the ship behind us morphs on the radar screen, sharp contours of hidden weapons blossoming from its formerly smooth hull. It follows us into the atmosphere, and it fires. Our pilot twists her thin hands in the gel controls. My stomach lurches. Hypersonic depleted uranium shells scar the canvas of clouds and icy terrain, superheating as they streak past. The ship jerks as we hit atmosphere ourselves. Our pilot continues to juke, twitching her fingers in the electric gel, face placid and lost in her dance with the pursuing craft. Her eyes distant from her body, a single droplet of sweat beading on her right temple and trickling down her jaw. Then a grey blur rips into the cockpit, and she explodes in a shower of meat, spattering the viewports and my face with blood. The uranium shell takes off the top half of her body, then rips through the floor. A second shell, the size of a child's head, screams through the ship between Mustang and me, punching a hole in floor and ceiling. Wind shrieks. Emergency masks fall into our laps. Warning sirens warble as pressure rushes from our ship, whipping our hair. I see the blackness of the ocean through the hole in the floor. Stars through the hole in the ceiling as our oxygen leaks out. The pursuing ship continues to fire into our dying ship. I huddle in terror with my hands over my head, teeth locked together, everything human in me screaming. Laughter, evil and inhuman, rumbles so loud I think it's coming from the buffeting wind. But it comes from Ragnar, his head tilted back as he laughs to his gods.
Odin knows we are coming to kill him. Even false gods do not die easily.
He throws himself from his seat and runs down the hall, laughing insanely, not listening as I shout for him to sit down. Shells whisper past him.
I am coming, Odin. I am coming for you.
Mustang dons her emergency mask and pushes the release on her safety webbing before I can gather my thoughts. The ship bucks, slamming her into the ceiling and the floor, hard enough to crack the skull of any but an Oriate. Blood spills over her forehead from the gash in her hairline,